When Pyro dreams of the cows and the attractive, robust cows, which represent years of prosperity, years of financial success, it's a very interesting phrase describing their appearance. We would expect the Torah to describe these paros as paros yafos. V'nei min hayor olos sheva paros yafos. Brios basar. There's an extra word, though, not just attractive or healthy of meat, healthy of flesh, but yafos mareh, they seem or they look very attractive and they look very healthy. There's a description about how they appear, not just their essence or how healthy and robust they actually are. So Rashi quotes the Medrash, of course, that this is a reference or an allusion to a subjective reality, not just how healthy these cows were or weren't, but they saw each other, so to speak, in this dream. They looked favorably upon each other. They recognized and appreciated each other's healthiness or beauty. Rashi writes, they were looking, again, Rashi doesn't describe the dream, but presumably in the dream, there was an interaction between the cows looking at one another, yafos mareh, or possibly not the cows, but people who saw the cows in the dream looked at the cows with favor in a very positive and embracing fashion. And Rashi sees this as a dream within a dream or a code within a code. The larger code for the dream is, of course, 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine, 7 years of success, and 7 years of suffering. But within that is almost a moral message that during years of prosperity, when people are satisfied, when people are content, they look more favorably and positively upon one another. But as they begin to suffer and they begin to experience either starvation, famine, or financial stress, then they become much more intolerant of one another's success, jealous, envious, competitive. So within the dream, either the cows were favoring one another, or people were favoring each other's cows or each other's herds, which represented that during years of success, the social fabric would be healthier. People would be more more content with other people succeeding, not only their own success. And during famine, of course, the social fabric would begin to unravel, where when people are under financial stress and there's limited resources, people become much more competitive and much more adversarial towards each other's success. And to a degree, that was maybe even a warning to Pyro that it wasn't just the financial stability of his kingdom that would suffer, but ultimately the social fabric. So Rashi writes, Simenuli me sova. It's indicative, these cows that look favorable to each other or to the shepherdsmen, it is a reflection or a code for the years of success. Shabrios Neros Yafas Zolazo, that people are excited and endorsing of each other's success. Shein Ein Beria Tsara Bechavrata, that people are not in any way short-sighted or evil-sighted when other people succeed. So it reminds us, of course, not just of a financial reality, that when people are successful, it's easier for them to embrace, not just tolerate, but embrace and champion, celebrate other people's success. But it's true at a psychological level as well. So much of the reason we oftentimes negate each other's views, each other's ideologies, each other's lifestyles, is when we're discontent or frustrated with our own lifestyle. When we reach internal peace and we're confident and satisfied with our own lives and our own goals and our own missions and our own success, it's easier for us to validate or to ratify other people. But when we suffer in our own ability to self-validate and we experience what I would call existential famine, where our identities are ravished and we're not comfortable in our own goals and agendas, it's precisely those moments that we have a harder time validating or endorsing, acknowledging other people. We sometimes need that artificial ratification by negating other people, or even if it isn't as sinister as that implied, it's just harder for us psychologically to endorse and to verify other people's lifestyles when we're suffering to find our own identities and our own confidence and our own inner poise. Of course, every element that's a trigger in moral development is also a consequence. So if looking favorably upon people and endorsing their lifestyles is a product of inner contentment, then it's also a catalyst of inner contentment. And if we're able to appreciate and respect other people and their approaches, then it can itself catalyze or enable an inner peace. So on the one hand, inner peace and confidence in your own life gives a person the imaginative sweep and horizons to allow room for other people's lives. But on the same token, allowing room for other people's lives and validating their lifestyles also creates that sense of inner contentment and inner confidence. So it's an interesting Rashi, commenting not just on how the cows were biologically, but how they were viewed, either by their peers or at least by the human beings in the dream who may have occupied the dream. It's another interesting Rashi, a little bit further after Yosef has decoded the dream, has been appointed by Paro, has been celebrated by the entire nation, and as this parade and procession is proceeding through the streets of Egypt, he's heralded, he travels on the king's chariot, and he's referred to as Avreich by the populace, by the population. Keep in mind that Paro refers to him as Tzafnas Paneach, but he's referred to by the people as Avreich. So Rashi quotes three positions, and it seems to be a very dramatic discussion about how to decipher the term Avreich. The first opinion Rashi quotes is that Avreich is a play on the words of a play on the term that would refer to royalty. The word Rach or Reich in the Roman language, or in some foreign language, maybe the Aramaic language, but in Rome or Aramaic, the word Rach is a synonym for royalty or monarchy. And Rashi quotes the Gemara in Bava Basra, in which there was an expression referring to almost like a slang expression that employed the term Recha to describe monarchy. So Rashi, interestingly, doesn't quote a Medrash here, I believe. I haven't checked up on the Medrash, but Rashi comes up with a very original pshat, and hence Avreich was a synonym for someone that was an advisor to the king. And Av, in this case, would be a biological father to the Reich, who was Paro, but a friend, a confidant, a counsel. So Avreich was a way to refer to Yosef's role vis-a-vis Paro. He was a assistant to Paro. He was a consultant to Paro. He was literally like a father to Paro. Reich being Paro in foreign languages, Av being the role that Yosef occupied vis-a-vis Paro. Now, what's interesting is, once again, the appearance of a foreign word. That Yosef's nickname is taken from a foreign language. I've mentioned this in the past. For example, the purchase of land by Yaakov in Parshas Vayishlach with Mea Kesita, with the term Kesita being a reference to currency in a foreign language. Of course, Yigar Sadusa, Rabbi Akiva's definition of Totafot as an African-type way to describe the number four, which is a reference to the four Parshot Tefillin Shel Rosh. It's intriguing that Yosef's nickname now becomes associated with a foreign word. It's natural. You'd expect it. Because Yosef's living in a foreign land. In fact, it's strange that the other interpretations of this nickname are based on seeing the word Avreich as a Hebrew-based name. You wouldn't expect your average Egyptian to know Hebrew. So it makes sense that Yosef's nickname, at least the population's nickname, shouldn't be Hebrew. But it also maybe reflects the fact that Yosef has become culturally integrated. He doesn't have to choose that nickname. He doesn't have to choose that password or that username. They may have said it, but evidently he embraced it at some level and the name became popularized. So maybe, and Yosef, of course, is a very, very ambiguous figure. Chazal have a lot of ambivalence about how deeply he does or doesn't become meshed in the Egyptian culture. On the one hand, he seems to maintain his Jewish identity. He refers to himself as an Ivri, or at least people refer to him as an Ivri, at least in the beginning in Parshas Vayeshev. At some later point in Parshas Vayigash, he hinges people's receiving food upon their receiving a bris milah. He still understands Hebrew, and that's why he's able to understand the misgivings and the frustrations of the brother. On the other hand, there are certain points at which Yosef appears to be very Egyptian, and this may be such a point, and Rashi may be emphasizing that by stressing that, at least according to the first pshat in Rashi, the word Avreich incorporates an Egyptian, or excuse me, a foreign term. this Rashi continues, and he quotes the Medrash, in which there's a very livid conversation between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis. Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis is not someone that we have too many halachic statements from. He was a third-generation Tana. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Elazar ben Horkinus, so he definitely is part of that Masara. But we have a lot of statements of him and from him in the Medrash. And what's interesting is why he was called Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis. Obviously, that word Dormiskis evokes Damesek, Damascus. Did he come from Damascus? Did his mother come from Damascus? Ben Dormiskis. Some say his mother was actually a Giyaris. So there's an interesting figure that makes its way into Rashi. But more interesting than his heritage is his very combative language to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda interpreted the word Avreich famously as Av Bechachma Rach Bishanim, that Yosef was very wise, like a father, but he was very young. He was still seen as a younger member. He was referred to as a nar. He was hustled from the boar. So it was a conjugation that contrasted. It was almost an ironical nickname. He was so young, and yet he demonstrated wisdom, as we would say, beyond his years. And somehow Rabbi Yossi, when he heard what Rabbi Yehuda had said, got very irritated. And he said, Ad Masai Atam Me'aves Aleinu Asaksuvim. How much longer, Rabbi Yehuda, will you continue to, we would say, warp and contort and distort the psukim? It's a very harsh language. And Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis evidently thought that Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation entailed too much textual or verbal manipulation. It was too far-fetched. It was too distant from the text. And Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis instead offered a different shot, that the word Avreich doesn't mean Av Bechachma Rach Bishanim, but refers to the knees, that people... He doesn't say it this way, but either had to bow down to Yosef, or at least were walking under his protection and under his supervision. It's almost as if symbolically they were walking under his feet. So he was seen as a towering figure, so to speak. He was called, they were all sheltered by his persona, by his personality, and they walked under his sponsorship. It's interesting that Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis was so irritated and agitated by Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation of Avreich as Av Bechachma Rach Bishanim. It doesn't seem to be that much different than certainly Rashi's interpretation, which is also a conjugation, Av Lamelech, Av to the Reich. Even if you compare Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis' position to Rabbi Yehuda's position, they're each interpretive, they're each seeing some symbolic reference in this term Avreich, rather than interpreting it literally. According to Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis, refers to Yosef's knees, which is a very vague, abstract notion of being walking in someone's shadow or walking under someone's sponsorship. Why would that be so much different than Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation of Av Bechachma Rach Bishanim? Would it be impertinent for the population to refer to Yosef in that way? Maybe they didn't know that he had been so wise. They just saw that he was appointed by Paro. They didn't hear or at this point yet know what his role would be. So they couldn't really identify his wisdom. They could just identify that he had been appointed as an authority figure under whose authority they operated, so to speak, under whose knees they walked. So it would be legitimate for them to refer to his knees through the term Avreich, but it may not be necessarily relevant or even in any way accurate that they should recognize his wisdom. Ultimately, as the years of famine arrive and this plan is put into motion, they're in touch. Remember, they don't know Paro's dream, and they may not even know this program and agenda of Yosef, so they have little way to know that he's wise. They may have a way to know that Paro has appointed them, as has appointed Yosef, as a quasi or vice president, a viceroy, and therefore they have to be submitted and subvergent to his knees and to his authority. So it's an interesting debate. What I find intriguing is, historically, it's the position of Rabbi Yehuda that sticks, as aggressive as Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskis was in rejecting Rabbi Yehuda's position. Today, in a world of Baruch Hashem, there's a lot of Torah being learned by people even well into the years of their marriage. So, especially, I think, probably more popular, I think, in the Haredi world. And in the non-Haredi world, I think people become teachers at an earlier age. So you learn for 10 years, 15 years, and then you start teaching. So by the time you're 35, many people are already teaching. In the Haredi world, where people are learning without teaching well into their older years. So that has to be a term that refers to someone who's not yet a Rebbe, who's not yet the actual teacher. And the term Avreich has stuck. Someone who's young, so to speak, in their years, but is sitting and learning, and sitting and learning extensively. And that term has become almost a synonym for a kollel person, an Avreich. Of course, it refers primarily, and it starts when people are learning when they're younger, when they're Rach B'Shanim, but that term has been extended to people learning at many, many different stages to highlight that they're a big Talmud Chacham, even though they're very young, and they're trying to become a Talmud Chacham during the process, and they're referred to as an Avreich. So, ironically, Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskus felt that this was a distortion of the textual, literal meaning, but it's really the pshat that most of us are familiar with. And it's interesting because there are other statements of Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskus which may have indicated that he was a little bit older than Rabbi Yehuda, even though they argued with one another and they occupied the same base medrash. There are a lot of machloks in between them. It seems as if he's a little bit older than Rabbi Yehuda, and therefore he looks at him, ironically, as an avreich, and may feel more comfortable issuing opposition statements that are a little bit harsh and a little bit rough around the edges, as we would say. So two very interesting Rashis. One about how not just the physical condition of the cows, but how the cows interacted with one another. Number two, this debate between Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskus and Rabbi Yehuda about interpreting Avreich with, of course, Rashi's additional pshat. Rashi interpreting it as an assistant to the Reich, to the king, a foreign word, possibly identifying Yosef's acculturation, whereas Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskus and Rabbi Yehuda focus on not his role vis-a-vis Paro, but the authority he had been vested, according to Rabbi Yossi ben Dormiskus, the authority that people were now walking under his supervision, or, famously, Avreich, young but old.